This is the Everything Financial Radio Program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you decided to tune in today. If you're a new listener, welcome. This is where we talk about the economy and your money. And I have a very interesting show lined up for you today. Joining me momentarily is Mr. Lawrence Reed, who is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. Their website is fee.org. You should check out the fine work they do there. Mr. Reed wrote a very provocative article that I'll be talking to him about today. And the title of the article is, Was Jesus a Progressive? Was Jesus a social liberal advocating the redistribution of wealth or not? And it's an interesting perspective Mr. Reed has. I'll be asking him some questions along those lines. We'll also be getting his take on what the economy's doing, what lies ahead, what's the end game based on today's monetary policies. And I'll be talking on today's program about a couple different cycles that are important to understand. I'll be talking about the money currency cycle, and I'll be talking about economic cycles. These cycles are slow moving. They're not noticeable. You have to study history to understand they exist. But when one does study history, you find, we believe, that they're historically predictable. And when something's historically predictable, that can be a very valuable perspective to have moving ahead when deciding how you want to manage your nest egg. Also, a quick reminder, if you've not yet attended a new retirement rules class, we do have another one coming up on March the 28th, which is a Saturday. If you'd like more information on the class or you'd like to register while capacity remains, all you have to do is visit the website, New Retirement Rules. There's a place on the website to register if you'd like. You can also nose around there and get more information. Quick reminder also, our show is produced into two podcasts every week, which you can subscribe to by visiting the iTunes store and searching under Everything Financial Radio. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on today's program, Mr. Larry Reed. Larry is the president of the Foundation for Economic Education. He has held that position since 2008 and has been with the organization, I believe, since the 1970s. Prior to becoming the president of the Foundation of Economic Education, he served 20 years as president of the Mackinac Center for Public Policy in Midland, Michigan, and he also taught economics full-time from 1977 to 1984 at Northward University in Michigan. And welcome back to the program, Larry. Great to have you.
Hey, thank you, Dennis. It's always a pleasure.
You know, you write some of the most thought-provoking articles out there, and you just wrote an article that caught my attention that talked about the fact that Jesus maybe was not a progressive. Can you explain a little bit about the article, then we'll dig in and talk about some of the details?
I'd be happy to. In fact, anyone can read the article in its entirety by going to our website at fee.org and just typing in Jesus progressive or something like that, and it'll come right up. Well, there are a lot of folks who are under the mistaken impression that Christ favored such things as redistribution of wealth, and progressives today often justify government doing that in the name of, hey, this is what Jesus would do. But I think a solid reading of the New Testament clearly puts Christ on the side of solving problems, social problems, through things like voluntary cooperation and private individual charity from the heart, not from calling upon government to do it in your place. And there are many passages that seem to verify that time and time again.
Well, you know, some of the cynics might say that Jesus said, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's. Doesn't that justify redistribution of wealth?
Well, keep in mind, he did not say that what belongs to Caesar is anything that he claims. It doesn't say that give it to Caesar no matter what he does with it or how he gets it or how he chooses to spend it. It's really a sort of private property reference. In a sense, he's saying, look, if it belongs to Caesar, give it to him. But it doesn't say, but give him anything else that he claims as well. So, you could say, well, what if you have an environment that I would favor, a very limited government with low taxes and lots of private property, free enterprise, and the Caesar in that case, or government, taxes very lightly. Well, Christ would say the same thing. Render unto that Caesar whatever really rightfully belongs to him. But he never said to give him anything more than that. So there's no automatic justification from that passage for socialism or for redistribution of the wealth, whatever.
Well, Larry, you know, I guess where do you draw the line in your view? And I would encourage the listeners to go check out the article at FEE.org. But at what point does someone say, you know, they're taking more than they need to, they're spending money foolishly, and how is that justified for the Christians that might be listening to today's program?
Well, there is no passage in the Bible that says, you know, if government takes more than X percent, it's wrong. So we as people have to sort of read the principles of the Bible into principles that we want established for government. When you start to understand what Christ was preaching, you realize that he was talking about higher, loftier things. He was asking people to put their sights on a higher authority. Never calling for the forced redistribution of wealth in any way clearly suggests that he wanted problems that we often use government to solve. He wanted them to be solved through private initiative, personal responsibility, people from the heart caring for those around them. He even had an opportunity to redistribute wealth himself when a man came up to him and asked him to do so. This is recorded in the book of Luke. And the man says, Master, speak to my brother, that he divideth the inheritance with me. And Christ could have redistributed wealth by the wave of his hand, but instead he chose to upbraid the man by calling into question his envy. And he immediately said, Who made me a judge or divider over you? Take heed and beware of covetousness. So I think we have to read into that Christ would not favor the massive, forcible redistribution of wealth through government. He was talking from start to finish about things of the heart, not things of the government.
So, Larry, when you'd mentioned earlier in our conversation that Christ favored the private sector, those aren't exactly your words, but the private sector taking control of charitable causes, charitable issues, as opposed to government. What scripture would back up that particular position, or do you have some examples?
Well, by private sector, I mean, again, voluntary, personal choice, a person actually getting personally involved in the assistance of others. Keep in mind the story of the Good Samaritan. Why was that Samaritan a good one? He came across a man who had been beaten and robbed nearly within an inch of his life. And the Samaritan didn't say to him, oh, well, call your social worker, or, maybe the emperor can help you. Instead, the Good Samaritan immediately and personally, with his own resources, came to the aid of the man in need. If he hadn't done so, if he had simply sloughed it off and said, well, that's a government responsibility, I really don't think 2,000 years later we'd be calling him the Good Samaritan. We'd more likely be calling him the good-for-nothing Samaritan.
Well, and in the time we have left, there's also a passage that you mentioned in your article, Matthew 19:23, and I'm paraphrasing, but Christ says in that passage, truly I tell you, it will be hard for a rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven. How does that fit in? It seems then that maybe is he saying that money is evil there, or you should redistribute wealth? That would be an argument that the progressives might use as well.
I know some people do interpret that passage that way. But bear in mind, these things have to be understood in context and be placed alongside of other passages so that they're consistent and not contradictory. Recall that the Apostle Paul clearly says that it's not money that's the root of all evil, but rather the love of money. And in Matthew 19:23, when Christ said it would be hard for a rich person to get into the kingdom of heaven, he was not saying that riches are bad. The parable of the talents, where Christ actually rewards the man who turned his wealth into the greatest additional wealth, would seem to defy that. What he's saying is that when you have riches, you have temptations. And there are, in fact, lots of temptations in life. Power is another temptation. He's not saying no one should ever have any power. But he's saying, don't let riches go to your head. Don't worship them. Don't let them get in control of you. He would be, I think, very praiseworthy or praising of a man or a woman who created wealth and used it to solve problems, employ people, generate value. Those sorts of things are not anti-Christian in any way, shape, or form.
Well, we're chatting today with Mr. Larry Reed, who is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. The website is fee.org. I would encourage you to check it out. And I'll continue my conversation with Mr. Reed when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. This is the Everything Financial Radio program. Welcome back. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I'll be continuing my conversation with Mr. Lawrence Reed of the Foundation for Economic Education in the next segment. Now, on today's program, I want to talk a bit about cycles, as I mentioned at the opening. And in this segment, I want to talk about the money currency cycle. And you know, the money currency cycle is something that many folks, including many in the financial industry, are not aware of. And this money currency cycle has repeated itself many times throughout history. And this money currency cycle actually leads to some of the economic cycles that we talk about so often on this program. Now, to talk about these cycle characteristics, and I'll focus in this segment on the money currency cycle, there's a couple characteristics that are really important to keep in mind. First of all, these cycles are slow moving. They move very, very slowly, and as a result, these cycles are not noticeable while they're evolving. In order to understand these cycles and to see that these cycles exist, you have to study history. But when you do study history, you understand that these cycles become very, in our opinion, historically predictable. Now, I want to talk again, for those of you that are new listeners, about the difference between currency and money, and then I'll get into the money-currency cycle and give you some examples from U.S. history as to how these cycles evolve and how they create these economic cycles that, again, we believe are very predictable. So starting with the definition of a currency. A currency, which would represent the dollar bills you have in your pocket or $5 or $10 bills you have in your pocket, currency is a medium of exchange. You use it in commerce. You use it to buy goods and services. Currency is a unit of account. Currency is portable. Currency is durable, at least somewhat durable. It's divisible, meaning you can make change. And it is fungible, meaning each unit is the same as the next. A dollar in my pocket can be used the same way as a dollar in your pocket can be used. So currency, again, is a medium of exchange, a unit of account. It's portable, durable, divisible, and fungible. Money is all those things, too. Money is a medium of exchange. Money is a unit of account. Money is portable, durable, divisible, and fungible. But money is also, and here's the very, very important point, money is also a store of value over a long period of time. Now, if you think about currency, governments can print more currency, and because governments can print more and more currency and dilute the currency supply, your wealth is eroded. Essentially, what's happening when this money printing occurs is wealth is transferred from you and your bank account in the form of decreased buying power. Your dollars don't buy what they one time did. That's why whenever a lot of folks sit down to do retirement planning, they put in a factor for inflation. Essentially, that's a factor for devaluation of currency. Now, money, on the other hand, has historically been a good store of value. And one example of money that's often been used historically are gold and silver. They provide an easy medium of exchange. They store a fairly large amount of value in a small space, and they offer a unit of account. But they also have tended to hold their buying power over a period of time. Now, this brings me to my topic, which is the money currency cycle. And it's really important to understand this if you're going to understand these economic cycles. At some points historically, currency has been money. At other points, it hasn't. Currency has been money when gold and silver circulated as currency. So at that point, they were the same thing. So to give you an example, through 1933, up until 1933, really from 1879 to 1933 in the United States, there was a 1 ounce gold coin that circulated as currency. This 1 ounce gold coin represented $20. At this time, money was currency. That's the first type of currency. Money and currency are the same thing. Then as time passes, and you see this at many points historically, going all the way back to the 1600s, currency has been a paper note or paper receipt redeemable for the real money. So some of you may remember something called a silver certificate. A silver certificate circulated in the United States from 1878 to 1964. A silver certificate, just say, for this example's sake, say a $10 silver certificate had no real intrinsic value, but it could be redeemed for $10 in real silver. So at this point in the currency money cycle, currency and money weren't the same thing, but currency was a piece of paper that was redeemable for the real money. Then, at some points historically, including today, there's been no link between currency and money. At this point, the currency is a fiat currency. The currency has no intrinsic value, but it's currency only by government decree. We use it in commerce. So you have this currency money cycle where you have hard money circulating, hard money, real money is currency, and then you have paper currency with a link to hard money. Then you have a fiat currency, and then as we've talked about here on the program, historically speaking, when you examine fiat currencies that have existed, there's been a 100% failure rate when it comes to fiat currencies. Now, why does this transformation occur? Well, faced with three choices to deal with debt excesses and deficits, which choice do you think politicians in nearly every century have chosen? Because there's only three ways to deal with debt or deficits. You can raise taxes, you can cut spending, or you can print money. And in order for money printing to occur, the currency has to be a fiat currency. Today, every currency in the world is a fiat currency. Now, just to take a look at this currency money cycle in context of what's happened in the United States, let's just go all the way back to the 1860s. During the 1860s, President Lincoln, in order to finance the Civil War, had Congress pass some banking acts that then backed the U.S. dollar, not by gold and silver, but by government debt. That allowed money printing to occur. And then in 1879, for reasons that we'll talk about, the country went back on the gold standard. Gold and silver were once again used as currency, so currency was money. That was the case until 1913 when the Federal Reserve was formed. When the Federal Reserve was formed in 1913, the first thing that the Federal Reserve did was reduce the backing of the U.S. dollar by gold. From 1873 to 1913, for that entire 40-year time frame, the dollar was backed 100% by gold, but the Federal Reserve reduced that backing in 1913 or shortly after to 40%. That expanded the money supply. We saw a period of time known as the Roaring Twenties because this money currency cycle leads to economic cycles. It's a cause and effect relationship. And then in 1933, the U.S. dollar once again became a fiat currency. But then after World War II, as part of the Bretton Woods Agreement, the dollar was once again linked to gold until 1971, about 30 years later or so. That's when the dollar once again became a fiat currency. And this money currency cycle leads to economic cycles that we will talk about. We talk about these cycles in great detail at our new retirement rules class. If you've not yet attended, we do have another class coming up on March the 28th. It will be held at the downtown Western Michigan University campus. March 28th is a Saturday. The class will begin at 9 a.m. and conclude at 2:30 p.m. All the details are posted at the website, newretirementrules.com. I'd encourage you to go check it out. And if you've not yet attended the class, we would invite you to register there as well. The website, again, newretirementrules.com. I'll be back to continue my conversation with Mr. Lawrence Reed after these words.
Give me your money. Just give me money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I have as my guest today Mr. Larry Reed, who is president of the Foundation for Economic Education. It's always great to have Larry on the program. And the website, if you want to check out the organization, I love their work and I'd encourage you to do that. It's FEE.org. And Larry, you are, without a doubt, a very, very astute historian when it comes to all things economic. And I thought in this segment it'd be interesting for our listeners if we were to discuss some of the parallels that you see between where we are today, economically speaking, and where we were maybe in the late 20s or early 30s at the onset of the Great Depression. And let's just start with maybe some of the bigger parallels that you see. Could you outline those for the listeners?
I'd be happy to, Dennis. Every recession or depression that we've had in our history, and this is true of other countries as well, was preceded by an inflation of money and credit, by a boom of some sort that was fed by what some would call easy money, cheap money, low interest rates. If you think back just to the years before the 2008 crash, we had record low interest rates. The Federal Reserve was keeping them low for an extended period after 9/11 in 2001, and that fostered an artificial boom that could not last. It created a bubble in things like housing and real estate that was made worse by acts of Congress and the bureaucracy that forced banks to make loans they shouldn't have. And the same was true before the Great Depression that started in 1929. You had 5 years of the so-called Roaring Twenties, easy money, the Federal Reserve depressing interest rates to around 1%. With easy money flooding the economy, lots of economic activity was generated. But the problem is it's not real. It's not sustainable. It will ultimately lead to some correction when interest rates rise, and those seemingly profitable investments during the boom disappear or become unprofitable. We're doing the same thing again today. In fact, every time we have a recession, you don't have the government saying, "Oh, sorry, folks, we helped cause that by our inflation of money and credit. We're not going to do that again." Instead, they go back to the bottle, you might say, drugging the economy with cheap money. And all that does is make things appear to be better for a time, but it sets you up for the eventual correction. I think we're seeing signs now of another bubble in the stock market. We're probably seeing the early signs of one in the housing market again. There's a story in this morning's Wall Street Journal about the explosion in so-called subprime loans once again. So here we go. Once again, I don't know when this is going to bust, but as long as the government keeps pursuing the same policies of spiking the punch bowl and we're all drinking it, then it's only a matter of time when things go in the other direction.
You know, Larry, when you talk about easy money and low interest rates and actually, you know, printing money virtually out of thin air, which they're doing now in Europe, you know, that the idea that you can print money and have easy money policies, that can only go on for so long. In fact, I'm reminded of the quote that I often use on the program, the late economist Herbert Stein, who said, "If something cannot go on forever, it will stop." How do you see this playing out, and how do you think our listeners might be affected?
Well, the problem, of course, is that our monetary policy is decided by politicians and people they appoint, and they tend to think short-term. They don't plan for the long run. It's sort of, as the French would say, après moi le déluge. In other words, after me the flood. Somebody else will figure it out later, but for now let's do this. It's important for policy planners to be thinking long-term, and because most of them don't, I see that as yet another reason to not give them the power in the first place, that this idea that they can regulate markets, determine what interest rates ought to be, inevitably leads to mischief, erosion of the currency, and economic recessions and depressions. So I think there's a lot of educating that needs to be done. The American people need to understand that these cycles don't come out of nowhere. they are the direct result of interference by government authorities in money and credit. And all this easy money that seems to be good for us in the short run is always bad for us in the long run.
So, Larry, here we are in 2015. There is not a currency in the world that is tied to something tangible like gold or silver, which many economists say is not all that important. What is your position on a currency tied to something tangible or a gold exchange standard? And do you think we'll see a return to that at some point in the future?
Well, I think gold will always be important. Governments for a time can sort of shunt it aside. But its history goes back too far, and the sentiment for it goes too deep, and the economics for it is are too strong for people to simply reject it and say, oh, we'd rather have politically issued, unbacked paper money. So gold is always going to be a prominent hedge or a refuge, especially if governments really overdo it with paper money. But I'm one of those who favors a true marketplace for money. While I think maybe backing the government's paper money with gold is a good idea, I would go a step further and not forbid in any way or bestow any special privileges upon market monies that arise. And one good example in this digital world of ours is Bitcoin, Litecoin, you know, some of these digital currencies. I have no idea what their long-term prospects are, but I sure like the idea that they can emerge, that people can freely choose them, and that they represent an option that people may want. And I hope that government will not put barriers in their way.
You know, Larry, you mentioned earlier in this segment that government policies often require banks to make less than stellar loans, to use that term. And I had as a guest on the program not long ago Mr. Peter J. Wallison, who was actually got a great book out on the subject. He was counsel in the White House under Ronald Reagan, and he talked about the fact that back in 1992, the regulations started to change to really force banks in a roundabout way, in a subtle way, to make loans that maybe they wouldn't otherwise make. And at the peak of the financial crisis, I think the number was almost 3 out of 4 loans, if not maybe even a little bit more than that, or mortgages, I should say, were subprime. So my question for you is, do you see anything happening from a government policy perspective to maybe reverse this trend, given that we've been through a financial crisis and it's pretty obvious that's what the cause was?
Well, under this president, no, I don't see that, because he has limitless faith in politicians and bureaucrats to push other people around and tell them what their economy ought to look like. But under a different president and a different Congress, perhaps, or better Congress, you may have a reawakening of and an understanding that, hey, we caused this problem. Let's not do that again. Mr. Wallison is right that some of this stuff goes back to the 90s, but it even goes back further. Under Jimmy Carter in 1977, we had the Community Reinvestment Act, which started jawboning banks to put a premium on giving loans to inner-city poor people, which, you know, again, best of intentions, but it causes the diversion of capital in unsustainable directions. And when those people can't pay their loans, you've hurt them as well as the banks and the economy that have been dependent upon the continued growth of those bad loans.
So, you know, to reverse this, I always joke that I am a libertarian capitalist. There's not many of us left on the planet. If we have these bureaucracies, we have these regulations, how difficult is it going to be to reverse this? It seems like every time a new bureaucracy is created, it doesn't go away. It seems like it only goes in one direction. What's your take on can this be reversed, and if so, how?
Yeah, Ronald Reagan once said that the nearest thing to eternal life is a government program. Well, if you've got someone with the persuasive powers of, say, a Ronald Reagan in the White House and who understands the economics of all this, you could conceivably turn this around, but it would require someone with leadership qualities to really educate the American people again and say, look, folks, this is what led to these problems. This is why we've got to unwind this. That's what Margaret Thatcher did when she came to office in the late 1970s in Britain. She leveled with the British people and said, our country is headed for the dumpster, and the problem is socialism, and we've got to take some tough medicine to reduce the size and the scope and the burdens of government, and that's what we're going to do. And she saved Britain by doing that, and she brought along a lot of people with her who realized this woman is making sense.
Larry, when you look ahead at 2016, we have, it's about 18 months or so that we will have another presidential election. When you look at the field of candidates, do you see anyone, in your view, that would have the persuasive ability to turn this trend around?
We don't endorse candidates at fee, and so I'm very careful even when I express a personal opinion to be careful about that. But I can say this much, that the one candidate that I think best understands the idea of free markets, small government, and how big government has got us into this mess is Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky. I think he would be an educator president, one who would most of the time do the right thing and be very good at explaining why these things are necessary. So right now I think he's got the best program of any of the candidates that I can see.
Well, Larry, we've got about a minute and a half left, which is a perfect amount of time for you to explain to the listeners what FEE.org does, what the Foundation for Economic Education does, and how they can learn more about your work.
Okay. People can learn more about us by visiting our website, FEE.org. We are an educational organization devoted to working with young people ages 14 to 26 to acquaint them and inspire them with the economics and personal character required for a free society, free economy, private property, small government, personal responsibility, and entrepreneurship.
All right. Now, I would encourage the listeners to check out the website, FEE.org. I would also encourage you to check out the article we talked about on today's program. You can do that by going to FEE.org and searching under Jesus and Progressive. And it's a fascinating article. I'd encourage you to check it out. Larry, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Certainly hope you'll come back.
Thank you very much, Dennis. Count on it.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I am your host, Dennis Tubergen. I am here every week at this time, and thanks again to special guest today, Mr. Lawrence Reed of the Foundation for Economic Education, for joining us today. And if you're not familiar with Mr. Reed's work, I would encourage you to check out his fine work at FEE.org. You know, I've been talking this week about economic and money currency cycles, different that in our view are predictable longer-term cycles. And these characteristics of these cycles, I should say, are really a couple. One, they tend to be slow moving. They tend to be slow moving, as a matter of fact, that they're really not noticeable to most folks. And secondly, they're historically predictable in our view. And when you look at these money currency cycles, and as money evolves, certain predictable economic conditions emerge. So it's our view, and I think historically speaking, it's very, very obvious that certain changes in money create certain economic conditions. Well, understanding these cycles and understanding how the money currency cycle's evolution can change the way the economy operates and the way different investments might operate can be very important knowledge, or at the very least, give you a very important perspective when it comes to managing your nest egg. Now, just to recap the money currency cycle, there are certain times historically that money and currency have been the same thing. There are other times, historically speaking, that money and currency have not been the same thing. And I've given the example in the past of the $20 gold piece that was used as currency from up until 1933 in the United States. And this coin contained about 1 ounce of gold, and it was worth $20. Well, up during that time, silver was also being used as money, and from 1878 through the mid-1960s, something called a silver certificate circulated, and this was a piece of paper that could be redeemed for real money. So the piece of paper was currency, the silver was real money. Then at other times historically, we found that the link between this paper currency and real money has been broken, and our currency becomes a fiat currency. It becomes currency because the government says it's currency. Now, this cycle has repeated itself many times historically. We could go back and look, as we often have here on the program, at 18th century France. We could look at a number of other centuries and see that this money currency cycle exists. And as this money currency cycle evolves, predictable economic conditions tend to emerge. But let's just look in today's segment at what's happened in the United States history. In fact, if you go back and look at economic seasons, as we label them, and we borrow our labeling from Mr. Ian Gordon of the Long Wave Group. Mr. Gordon's been a frequent guest here on the program and a brilliant monetary and economic historian, so I would encourage you to check out his work as well. But if you look at the economic cycles, Mr. Gordon has labeled these economic cycles or sub-cycles after the seasons of the year: spring, summer, fall, and winter. Well, during the fall season, one of the characteristics is that we have the illusion of economic prosperity. It seems that everybody's doing well. Stock prices are rising. Real estate prices are rising. Everybody's working. And yet, one of the reasons that we have such a feeling of prosperity during this fall season is that debt is building. A lot of the prosperity that we see is debt-driven during this time frame, and it is driven by debt because of the monetary policies. And the monetary policies can be linked back to this money currency cycle. Then when debt in the system reaches its capacity, when the system can't just simply handle any more debt, the economic season changes from autumn to winter. There's a significant economic slowdown. And that may be an understatement. Slowdown is probably not a strong enough word to use there. And debt has to be purged from the system. So let's just go back and look at different times historically speaking. And let's look at most recently what's happened. In 1971, Richard Nixon, who was then president, eliminated the link between the U.S. dollar and gold. Up until that point, the U.S. dollar was redeemable directly for gold at a rate of $35 an ounce for foreign investors, and that arrangement, that exchange program, was set up as part of the Bretton Woods Agreement after World War II. Well, what happened? Well, in the 1960s, with Medicare and Medicaid becoming the law of the land, with the Vietnam War going on, government budgets were stretched tight, and politicians had the same three choices that politicians have had in every century to deal with debt excesses and deficits. They could raise taxes, cut spending, or print money, and they opted for the latter. And as they printed this money, many foreign investors got nervous. They were holding U.S. dollars, which were exchangeable for gold at a fixed rate, and a lot of foreign investors said, you know, I think I'd rather have my gold. And they began to exchange their paper U.S. dollars for gold. And eventually, because the U.S. had printed too much money, Richard Nixon was forced to suspend those redemptions of U.S. dollars for gold. So since 1971, the U.S. dollar has been a fiat currency. That really eliminates the discipline that the Federal Reserve has, and they can print as much money and have as easy a money policies as they want. That really happened after the interest rates were raised to a point at the end of the 70s, early 80s to slow down inflation, as interest rates then began to be reduced. From 1982 to 2000, there was this tremendous period of prosperity here in the United States. Well, during that time frame, private sector debt and public sector debt, for that matter, built. Then in 2001, we saw the tech stock bubble correct. We saw the real estate bubble build and burst. And now we have a very slow-growing economy. That's because of the easy money policies that have existed, because the currency money cycle creates these economic conditions. And now we're going to have to deal with the debt excesses that exist in the system. This same cycle happened if you go back to the Great Depression. Really, when one takes a look at the gold standard that was really in place from 1879 all the way through 1913, the dollar was backed 100% by gold. Then the newly formed Federal Reserve reduced the dollar's backing from 100% backed by gold to 40% backed by gold. And what happened? We had a period of time known as the Roaring Twenties, when it seemed that prosperity was everywhere. But in the background, again, There was private sector debt levels building to unsustainable levels. And what happened? Well, in 1933, the U.S. government decided that it would be not in the citizens' best interest or in the government's best interest for citizens to own gold, and the U.S. dollar once again became a fiat currency. And that was just the case until the Bretton Woods Agreement after World War II. So you see these cycles that exist, and these money currency cycles lead to economic cycles. And I certainly don't have time to discuss these cycles in great detail here on the radio, but it's important to understand that these links do exist in our view, and understanding these links can give you a really good idea as to how to manage your nest egg, because certain assets tend to perform well in certain economic conditions, and certain assets tend to perform not so well in certain economic conditions. So understanding this is really key to managing your nest egg moving ahead. I'd like to invite you to get some free resources to help you understand these cycles. These resources are readily available. They're based on education only. The first resource I've mentioned on the program several times, it's the new retirement rules class. The next new retirement rules class will be coming up on March the 28th. It will be held in downtown Grand Rapids. It's a Saturday class that begins at 9 a.m. and concludes at 2:30 p.m. The cost for the class for you and a spouse, significant other, or guest is just $49. That's the cost of the book that you'll get before the class. You can do some reading before the class. We'll send you a letter, tell you what chapters to read if you don't have time to read the whole book, so you get the most out of the class. You'll also get handouts while you're at the class, and we will give you a class binder that you'll be able to take with you from the class that we hope will be a valuable resource moving ahead. Again, the website, if you'd like to check it out or get more information or register, is newretirementrules.com. There's another ongoing resource that we have available for you as well. Of course, we'd encourage you to listen to the Everything Financial Radio program when it airs in your market. But we would also invite you to go visit the iTunes store and search under Everything Financial Radio. When you do that, you'll find that our program each week is produced into two podcasts that you can subscribe to, and you can listen to the content here on the program and our interviews with all our guest experts at your convenience. So if you'd like to listen again to the conversation I had today with Mr. Lawrence Reed, you can do that. All you have to do is visit the iTunes store again and search under everythingfinancialradio.com. If you'd prefer, you can also go to everythingfinancialradio.com, where we post our interviews and programs each week, so you can listen to them at your convenience or download them from that resource as well. That's our program for this week. Again, in the few seconds I have left, let me remind you that if you've not yet attended a new retirement rules class, I would encourage you to go to the website, New Retirement Rules, and check it out, get more information, and register there while capacity remains. That's our program for this week. Thanks for listening.